Hey everyone, it's Marvin. This episode of Books and Boba is brought to you by Home Interrupted, a new podcast from our partners at Feet in Two Worlds. Climate change affects everyone, but it doesn't affect everyone equally. Immigrants often bear a unique burden due to climate change, but they're also leading the way with impactful solutions. Feet in Two Worlds, the news outlet and journalism training organization for immigrant voices, presents Home Interrupted. From flooded basement apartments in New York City to indigenous Maya farming practices in Nebraska, Feet in Two Worlds' Home Interrupted brings you deeply reported original stories from across the United States. Episodes drop each week starting April 2nd. Find Feet in Two Worlds' Home Interrupted wherever you listen to podcasts.
You're listening to
Whoa!
Potluck.
And you're listening to Books and Boba, a book club and podcast featuring books by Asian and Asian American authors. My name is Marvin Yeh.
And I'm Rira Yu.
And on this episode, we're bringing you an author chat with Tan Thuong Eng about his latest novel, The House of Doors. As always, Books and Boba is supported by our listeners at patreon.com/booksandboba, where members of our Patreon get access to our members-only Patreon server, as well as our monthly bonus podcast, Boba Chats. But yeah, we had a really great chat with Thuong about his journey into becoming an author, as well as his latest novel, The House of Doors.
Yeah, we learned a lot about his process in researching the time setting and also writing around real characters, because we have very big name characters like Sun Yat-sen and William Somerset Maugham, who is like a very famous author. Let me just say, I'm just gonna like reveal this about myself. I did not know that much about those two historical figures. So I learned a lot when I was reading this book.
Yeah, I mean, I knew a lot about Dr. Sun Yat-sen, but
of
that's just because he's, you know, the father of modern China. But I definitely did not know that Somerset Maugham was a real person until I did some ancillary research while reading this book.
Well, like I've heard of him as a writer, obviously, but I did not know that he traveled around the world and he actually was actually in Malaya and wrote about this murder trial that actually happened. So it was a very interesting setting that Tan Thuong Eng wrote for this book. So I hope you guys enjoy our conversation with him.
Yeah, and now our chat with Tan Thuong Eng.
And we are here with Tan Thuong Eng, the author of The Gift of Rain, The Garden of Evening Mists, and most recently, his newest novel, The House of Doors. Welcome to the show, Thuong.
Thank you, Books and Boba. Thank you very much for inviting me to your show.
Yeah, your book just came out this week, which is, I guess, we'll be releasing this the week after. So last week, congratulations on the release of your third book. You're now on your book tour, which is how we're able to catch you while you're in the States, even though we're on different coasts. But we always love to start off our author chats by getting to know, you know, as members of the Asian diaspora, we're always, you know, it's still really cool to see people that look like us writing books and being like published authors. So curious to hear, like, what was your journey into becoming a novelist?
Well, it's extremely difficult. I used to be a lawyer. I used to be an intellectual property lawyer in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia, where I'm from Malaysia. And, you know, like all Asian parents, which I'm sure you understand, my parents did not want me to be a writer. They wanted me to be a doctor, a lawyer, accountant, or engineer. So it was difficult to tell them that I really wanted to be a writer. So I just decided I'd be a lawyer. I'd qualify as a lawyer and work for a few years, and after that, to see whether I liked it or not, which I did not like it. And I wasn't a good lawyer because I was always telling my clients to settle and settle and settle, for the main reason that I was just too lazy to prepare the work for court. You know, hated preparing work, court work, to go into court and argue, because then you have to stay until midnight in the office. So I didn't do that. So eventually I decided to take a year off from work and just to do nothing, just just to see what I wanted to do. And again, being Asian, that you have to justify your gap year to your Asian parents. So I said, I'm going to do a master's in law somewhere. I chose Cape Town because I have friends there who said, why don't you come over and just try this place? I did. And I also, in the meantime, finished writing my first novel, The Gift of Rain, sent it off to the UK. I received an offer by an agent to represent me quite quickly. And then that's when the problem started, because they submitted to the publishers in England, and every publisher, they turned it down. They just turned it down. We asked for reasons why. So they compiled a thick sheaf of documents. The main reason seemed to be that the marketing department didn't want it because it was difficult to market. I was unknown. The subject matter was set in Malaya, in the 1930s and 40s. And the marketing department said, sorry, we don't know how to categorize this, so we're passing it on. Despite the enthusiastic reports from their editors said, we want this, but the marketing department said, we don't want that. And it was quite difficult getting published. It took about another 1 or 2 years before a newly formed independent publisher in Newcastle decided to sign me up to publish me. And even then, after he published me, the road was still full of obstacles because none of the bookshops wanted to stock the book. None of the bookshops in the UK. So he battled to really sell the book. Everything changed when The Gift of Rain was longlisted for the Booker Prize in 2007. And suddenly there was a demand and interest in the novel. And I have to say that really kickstarted, opened doors, I would say, for me.
Yeah, you have a great record with the Man Booker Prize. This is your third nomination. And, it's like a 100% streak now. Yes, how does that feel?
I just feel that I better stop writing so that all for the rest of my life I can tell people, all my books were nominated for the Booker Prize.
And quit while you're ahead.
Yes. I really wasn't expecting this book to be nominated at all, because in many ways, it's on the surface, The House of Doors looks very like an old-fashioned novel in many ways. And that was intentional. I wanted to create this facade of the sort of novel that you think you pick up and they say, this could have been written 80, 100 years ago. But underneath that facade, it's quite modern in the way I've constructed it and the themes and the issues that are being dealt with in that book. So I was extremely gratified when I was longlisted for the Booker Prize. That was a huge, huge honor, I have to say. And also because that my last book, The Garden of Evening Mist, had come out in 2012. So it's almost 10 years since the Booker Prize remembered me. So
I mean, you left an impression. I mean, 10 years is a long time to write a book.
10 years is a long time, yes. Yeah.
But some of the best novels that we've read for this book club has been a labor of love for a decade. And just curious, what took you so long to write House of Doors? What was the most challenging parts of it?
Getting over my inherent laziness, I suppose. The Garden of Evening Mist achieved some success, so I wanted to ride on the success and extend the interest in that novel. So every time there was an invitation to speak at any event or any festival, I would say yes, I would do it. So that disrupted my writing routine very much. I'm not the sort who can come back and resume immediately. I have to get into the zone. So that disrupted my writing routine. I had a health issue with my knee as well. My right knee. I found out that my right knee, the cartilage had become so thin. It was paper thin. Mm-hmm. The surgeon told me. So I had to do some. Surgery to try and fix it, but which wasn't successful. So, it just took so much out of me. And at that point, I had in mind a huge project, a multi-volume sort of story. And I found it too daunting to even think about it. So while I was doing physiotherapy every day, I thought, oh, let's write this little story I had in mind, which I kept in my drawer, because I felt that it wouldn't take much research. It would be quite easy to write. So imagine my ever-growing dismay when I realized that it wasn't easy to write, and I had to there were so many things I did not know. I had to do so much research on it. It was terrible. Yeah, it was. The hole that I kept digging, and I was going deeper and deeper, and I couldn't climb out. You know, it was a quite an horrible experience, I have to say.
Yeah, I mean, we'll definitely talk more about the story that you wrote, because it definitely has like a lot of layers to it. I kind of want to go back to, though. I'm actually curious what drew you to writing stories in the first place.
Like many writers, we started out as readers. We were obsessive readers. I started reading very young. My parents were very rare in that they never censored what I wanted to read. They just said, you can read whatever you want. If you read something you don't understand, just come and talk to us. We'll explain. We'll try our best to explain. So from a very young age, I could read ever I wanted, and I did. And I found this whole writing industry and the idea of writers and publishers and editors fascinating. Every time, even when I was a child, every time I opened a book, I would really study, you know, the copyright page and trying to decipher what all those things meant. You know, what is all these things? So it started from a very young age. I read a lot of very uninspiring books. And then when I did that, I just told myself, look, really, I can do much better than this. that's the ego of youth, you see. And also the laziness of youth. Of course, I didn't do anything about it. I just talked. It was all talk. It was only much later when I was doing my gap year that I said, okay, I've got time now. You know, all this talk, all these years about being a writer, you better sit down and start doing it, which I did. By that time, I had developed a sense of discipline as well, mainly through, because I had been doing the Japanese martial art of Aikido for about 10 years by then. And that really helped me with my discipline and mental discipline as well. So I could sit down for 8 hours a day and write.
Yeah. It's funny that you mentioned a lot how you have this inherent laziness where your genre of choice seems to be historical fiction, which is like the genre that requires the most amount of research to write. Like, how did that happen? How did you end up being historical fiction writer?
Well, the thing is, I don't see research as work. You see, it's so enjoyable and so fascinating, especially when you're researching a subject you find very interesting and compelling. And it's basically just reading and taking notes, isn't it? It's really not much, it's not working. But whereas with writing or even being a lawyer, it's actually work. And then it's hard work as well, despite what many people think. A lot of people think writing is very glamorous and exciting and fun, because you go to parties all the time and you have book launches and you get interviewed. But actually, that's only about 10% of the writing life. The 90% of it is sitting at your desk every day and forcing yourself to produce something. And I find that when it's going well, it's highly enjoyable. But when it's not going well, then I find it so frustrating. And it doesn't pay well as well. You know, the whole job, that's the bottom line as well, isn't it? You spend all this time and effort working and for very little financial rewards. You really have to do it only if you love writing.
Yeah, I can totally understand how research can be used as like a procrastination tool almost. It's like,
I'm
writing but not writing because I am doing research. And of course, like, you just go down the rabbit hole. But when do you know when to stop researching and just buckle down and write?
Well, I don't research everything before I start writing. So while I'm writing, if I come across a plot point, or I think of a new plot point which I want to explore, and I realize I don't know much about that subject matter where the plot point is heading towards, then I'll stop and start finding materials and reading about it. And once you feel that, okay, that's enough for what I want to develop here, you go back to the writing. The problem is sometimes you find very interesting stuff, and then you start branching out. You start thinking, oh, what about this? And then you really have to stop yourself and think, okay, what? You have to focus, basically, on the story that you want to tell, and not go off in tandem and get lost and confusing
yeah,
yourself.
It's all about pruning. Yeah, I mean, yes, it's fiction writing. You're not writing a nonfiction or a biography. So there's definitely more structure to it.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, I got to say, reading your book did send me down some Wikipedia rabbit holes, looking up these like real life characters that you included. So I learned a lot reading your book.
Oh, that's good. Yes, I intentionally left a lot of stuff. I didn't explain a lot of stuff because I want the readers to do some work. I think when the reader does a little bit of the heavy lifting themselves, they create a stronger connection with the book. Whereas if I just told you everything, it's basically a completely passive experience you're having. But when you have to dig around, you have to supplement some of the gaps in the novel. I think you feel that the book is more part of you, and you have a sense of ownership of the book rather than just being fed all the information.
Yeah, I definitely agree. Before we move into discussing further about House of Doors, your recent novel, I did want to ask you, since you are someone who grew up in Malaysia and whose books have been published through the UK, how has your experience been with the publishing industry and them publishing Asian stories? Because obviously it's very different from in American publishing. I feel like the... I mean, like, don't quote me on this, but I feel like the diversity here is there is more of a catalog, whereas with UK publishing, there's still an ongoing struggle to get diaspora stories or Asian stories written by Asian authors. Like, has that been an experience that you've had? Like, what has your experience been with the UK publishing industry?
It's been quite good, I have to say. Everyone's been very professional, but I can see that in terms of the sort of books being published, yes, America has a wider range of voices, more diverse voices. So, but things have changed from the first time I published my first novel to now. Things have really changed, and for the better as well. You see a more diverse series of writers, editors as well. For example, my British publishing house, Canongate, they are really taking steps to broaden the sort of writers they sign on, the sort of writers that they want to help and promote. So it has improved tremendously, I have to say. Maybe not as widely as the United States, but it's getting there. So, you know, we just have to keep pushing and pushing. That's life. So,
yeah, I think we have come a long way from historical fiction that is set in Asia, written by white authors who exoticize our culture or glorify colonization. So I do really enjoy seeing not just American authors, but like authors in Asia and also in other diasporas write about just like colonial history and how it affected our culture. And it's something that, you know, can go off in so many branches. And we can see that in your work. I mean, you have three books that are historical fiction that talks about Malaya. So, I'm like really grateful that you were able to dig deeper into that level of history.
Oh, so I'm grateful as well. I'm also grateful that there are readers who want to read my novels, regardless of where they come from or their age. I mean, I was quite surprised. You know, whenever I do these book tours or appear at literary festivals, I'm quite surprised but very grateful for the wide spectrum of the sort of readers I get. You know. From late teens to people in the 80s, men or women, people of all races. So the point is, I think, to write very strong stories with very compelling characters. That's the point to get people interested in your stories and your history. And also, it's very important not to preach you might have some lessons you want to preach, but you really that's incredibly off-putting for any reader. I don't want to read a book when I know that the author is preaching to me or is pushing an agenda on me. I don't want that. I want to experience human emotions, human fears, human hopes, human love. And that's what makes a book successful, I think, in the long run. Not just what is currently fashionable. But what is timeless?
Yeah, and what's timeless is characters who go through human struggles. Yes. And the human struggle has not really evolved, in my opinion.
No. We still have wars. We still have murder. We still have so many things. We still have adultery. We still have cheating. We still have so many bad things. And that's human nature, and I don't think human nature will ever change. That's a sad thing.
Yeah, I think that's a good segue into our discussion of your latest novel, The House of Doors. Can you give us a quick overview of what your newest novel is about?
Well, The House of Doors is set in two time frames, 1910 and 1921. In 1921, the British writer W. Somerset Maugham and his secretary are visiting the island of Penang, which is in the British colony of Malaya. He stays with his old friend Robert Hamlin and his wife by their home in their home by the seaside. Now, this is where he hears about a real life murder trial of an English woman in Kuala Lumpur, which will form the basis of one of his most well known short stories, The Letter. Now, this is my take on how he came to hear the story and wrote that short story, The Letter. It also has the real-life character of Dr. Sun Yat-sen, who was a Chinese revolutionary. At that time, he was traveling the world raising funds to fund his revolutionary attempts to bring down the Chinese monarchy and replace it with a Republican government. There are four real-life characters in The House of Doors, and they all converge on the island of Penang.
Yeah. What inspired you to base your story around these real-life characters?
Well, to start with, I first read Maugham's short story, The Letter, when I was in my teens, and I found it a very readable and compelling story. I was even more excited when I discovered that he had based it on this real-life trial, which had taken place in Kuala Lumpur 100 years ago. I was growing up in Kuala Lumpur, and to know that Somerset Maugham had been there and he heard about this trial and he wrote this short story, I found that I suppose the writer in me even then saw the potential for that. So The House of Doors is in a way a reverse engineering of The Letter. It's how Somerset Maugham could have come to hear about the story and then subsequently went on to write The Letter. That's one of the seeds of The House of Doors.
Yeah, it's interesting that, your story is, like you mentioned, an imagined origin story for these events that themselves are mythologized from actual events. Right? The Letter is his own take, Somerset Maugham's own take on the Ethel Proudlaw case. And also, Dr. Sun Yat-sen has become himself a mythologized figure as well.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah, so it's interesting to look at them at the beginning of their careers as it is, to see what made them become these legends that they eventually became. To see that that they're also human and full of pettiness and weaknesses and jealousy, all the things that make us human. So it was fun writing about these things to take them down from the pedestal and to show that they're human as well.
Yeah. It was also really interesting reading your novel because it takes place in, Malaysia, British colony of Malaya at the time, and it's told through the lens of British characters, as your POV characters, even though one of your main characters, Leslie, was born and raised in Penang. They still view the world through like a colonial lens. Like what, can you tell us why you decided to focus your story on these white POV characters?
Well, first of all, because The Letter involved an English woman who was on trial for killing her lover, so I to work backwards from that, I had to use also a white woman to see it from Ethel's point of view. It's I whenever you write a novel, you can't just have boxes and tick and say, okay, I want to do this. You can't. You have to see what works best, not only what works best, what works for your novel. And what works is that Somerset Maugham, I wanted Somerset Maugham to come to Penang, and I wanted him to stay with the family there to hear the story. Now, in the social milieu of that time, he couldn't have stayed with a Chinese family or Malay family or Indian family. No, there's no way. So it had to be an English couple. It's all these choices that you read are many times to de-glamorize writing. It's many times practical considerations. You have to be practical when you're writing your novel and to make the plot authentic and also believable, because otherwise you'll be trying to impose today's values onto a story which you're setting 100 years ago. And that's going to be an uncomfortable fit. And readers are not going to buy that. They're not going to believe that. So you really have to look at what the novel, your novel, your particular novel requires, and then try to do the best for it instead of just trying to say, okay, I want to tick all these boxes. You can't do that. It's impossible.
Yeah, it's kind of like archaeology. You're trying, you're deducing and linking pieces together. I thought Leslie was a very interesting character, not just because, you know, she is a white woman who was born and raised in Penang, but also because, you know, she knows Sun Yat-sen, and that's just such a weird connection to have. And she also knows Somerset Maugham, and that's like she's just a normal woman who is surrounded by incredible people making incredible plans. Like, how was it coming up with her character and her voice?
Quite easy, because first of all, she's actually quite similar to Ethel Proudlock. I wanted that similarity as well. I wanted to blur these two women as well, because it's, in many cases, what happens to Ethel Proudlock is a warning to Leslie as well, not to overstep the lines which society has drawn around her. So that's why she's so controlled, she's so careful, she watches what she says and what she does, because she's seen what had happened to her best friend Ethel when Ethel stepped across those lines. So she's terrified. She's obsessed with status and having a rich husband, because she comes from a middle class family and she wants all that. So she wants to protect all that. That's why she's so careful. But you know, she's more than that. She's more than this shallow person. She's also interested in leaving a trace of herself on history. And that's why she finds Sun Yat-sen so compelling and fascinating, because here is this man traveling the world. He's doing great things. And he's going to achieve great historical things. And she feels that as a woman, what avenues does she have? As she tells Somerset Maugham in one of the scenes in the book, the only way for a woman to be remembered by history is if she's either a queen or a whore. What about a normal housewife like me? Who is going to remember me? And that's, again, another reason why she connects with Somerset Maugham later on, because she senses that there's somebody here who could write her into immortality, which is what she's interested in. She wants to be remembered. I think all of us want to be remembered in one way or another. So here she is trying to leave some trace of herself on this world after she's dead and gone.
Yeah. I mean, reading your story, it reminded me of a lot of, like, you know, classic American plays about, like, messy white people and their affairs and their infidelities, but set in Malaya, set in like an Asian country. Yeah. Can you tell us about your inspirations of like writing the story and setting it in the setting? Like, how was that experience like for you?
Well, I didn't have much difficulty with it. I enjoyed writing this almost a drawing room drama, because really nothing, you know, compared to my previous two novels where so much cataclysmic events took place, to suddenly write this quite domestic drama, which many things taking place in just the house itself, you know, Kasawari House. Well, initially I found it quite hard because I'm thinking, okay, nothing's happening here. What do I do? You know, there's no war coming. They're not in the middle of a war. I can't ramp up the stakes or the tension. So I had to find different ways of doing that. I have to go into the emotions. I had to ramp up the stakes emotionally. It was much more hard to do that than to have external threats coming in. So it, in many ways, it was a learning process for me as well as a writer to develop this skill and this maturity to really sit down. There were many days when I was writing the novel where I did nothing more than just sit down and just put myself in the scene and, okay, try to feel what each character was experiencing, just to go deep and deep and deep. Quite exhausting, I have to say, when you come out from that. It's just like, oh.
I think it's pretty interesting how this book, it is about a different branch of diaspora. You know, it's not just, you know, Asian Americans or Asians living in the UK. It's like, you know, British people who are living in
it's a British diaspora.
It's a British diaspora. Yeah. And it makes you question, like, what is the difference between expat and immigrant? Like, what is the difference between those two labels?
Yeah, well,
I just want to hear your thoughts on that.
Well, I would say it depends on how much you're earning. You see, that's the thing. I think for they view expats as more white collar workers, executives, or people like that. Whereas, if they say it's migrant labor, then it's really blue collar and it's working with hands, which is quite condescending, I think, because to me, anyone who goes to another country to work is an expat, regardless of the sort of work he or she does. You're an expat. So try not to differentiate all of that. But it's interesting because I've often thought of that, and you're the first person who's ever spoken to me about that. I often ask my friends, you know, what's this? Why is expat and migrant labor? What's the difference?
Yeah, I mean, it was really interesting for me to like compare with my own experience as like an Asian American, Asian diaspora, and just like how you illustrate the difference between like, I guess the difference between like the immigrant and expat mentalities and how, you know, culture is claimed by the privileged, right? Like, I think one of the interesting things I picked up on is as you're reading, you know, Leslie's experiences, like she is someone who, you know, was born and raised in Malaya and by all accounts, like, is part of the culture, but at the same time, there is something a little off, right? Especially for those of us who grew up marginalized, we kind of can pick up on that. Whereas she grew up as like a member of like the imperial power, right? So definitely there is like a commentary on privilege and a commentary on like blind spots for, even though she is like, feels she's part of the culture.
She's part of the culture and because she's from a lower class background, the upper class Brits there also look down on her. So, you know, she doesn't really belong with a European crowd as well. And that's why she's always so, I think she's quite angry. She's a very angry woman. I didn't realize what an angry character.
I mean, most women are angry.
Yes. Yeah. And I did not realize, it was only after I finished my first draft and I read through it that I realized, but this is a very feminist novel, which I didn't set out to write. But I realized that if you're writing about a woman character 100 years ago, your story is going to bump up against all the restrictions that a woman faced in those days. And if your character is an intelligent and sensitive and aware character, she is going to chafe against these restrictions placed. She can see, I mean, any intelligent woman, regardless of which century you're living, can sense injustice. You know, it doesn't matter which age or century you're living in. Why can somebody do this just because he's a man, and me as a woman, I can't do it? Isn't it? That's, yeah. So it's inevitable, I think. And I'm very glad that I realized that while I was writing the novel, I wanted Leslie to do a lot of things on her own, to walk around the island, and then I realized she can't, you know, because for a woman of a class and her time, she can't do that on her own. There's a scene in the book as well where she wants to go to Kuala Lumpur on her own and stay in a hotel. And the husband said, "You can't. You're a married woman. What would people think if you check into a hotel on your own? You can't do it." So, things like that we take for granted today, but it was the norm about 100 years ago.
Yeah, and it makes sense that Leslie would participate in Sun Yat-sen's book club activities because, you know, it's a feeling of liberation in a way, because she is being a part of something that is bigger than herself. Yes. And as someone who didn't really know much about Sun Yat-sen, and I was just like very intrigued by how he was trying to collect funds from like the Chinese family.
The overseas Chinese.
The overseas Chinese. And yes. I think a lot of people don't understand how big, like how actually big the Chinese diaspora is and how many generations, you know?
Yes.
And you do introduce the Straits Chinese community in your book. Can you tell us more about that community and your personal ties to it?
Well, it's a subset of the Chinese community, because these are Chinese who had either... Now, within the Straits Chinese community, there are also various subsets as well. It depends on whether this group of Chinese had absorbed British influences and sent their kids to English schools and adopted the British way of life, or whether they've intermarried with the Malays or the Siamese or the Indonesians. So there are various fascinating and colorful subsets within the Straits Chinese. For me, my grandparents and great-grandparents, they were very much Anglophiles. So I'm from that subset, mainly in Penang. So again, it depends on which part of Malaysia that you were born in. That decides your fate, more or less. The languages you speak when you grow up, the sort of culture you were familiar with. So, but it's a very rich thriving cultures within this so-called Straits Chinese description.
Yeah, I love how the Chinese diaspora's communities in Malaya and like the Chinese characters, they all view each other differently. They're like, oh, like they don't understand what real China is about. Like they've betrayed us because they're up with the English. And
but
it's just a very funny and colorful
it's realistic commentary. I think it's realistic, because even today, you know, you've got mainly Cantonese speakers who are feeling antagonistic towards the mainly Mandarin speakers, or you're speaking some other Chinese language. And I don't even want to call them dialects, because there's so many different Chinese languages. They sound so different from one another. It's only the common writing system that share similarities with it. So there's so many different Chinese languages. So again, there's different ways, different cultures, different foods, different expressions and values within this Chinese description. But that's what makes life so great. There's so many, there's so much diversity. Richness there.
Chinese people have been settling in Southeast and like the islands of Asia for centuries before the white people even got here. So, you know, there's layers and layers, and, you know, immigration is all about like migration patterns. And, you know, my family's from Taiwan, so we have our own issue with different migration patterns and waves and things, right?
But it's fascinating. You know, imagine how dull if all of us spoke the same Chinese language, if all of us ate the same food and dressed the same way. I love this diversity, even when they're antagonistic. It's so much fun, I think.
Yeah, I always joke with my white friends, like, oh, Asians, we all hate each other. We all have,
we all need a common enemy to band against each other. Yeah.
But I noticed that all of your characters are pretty, like, they don't have happy marriages. They're quite lonely. Yes. And
it's a very anti-marriage book, isn't it?
Yes,
I also did not realize that when I was writing it until... It's basically also a commentary on when you put on masks, you know, all the characters wear masks, you can't really be happy. Because there's always the awareness that you're playing a role. And the only person, can you guess, the only person who is truly free, liberated and happy, which is that character in my book, is Gerald Haxton. He doesn't care what people think of him. He doesn't care what the judgment and values of society. He does what he wants. He says what he wants. And he's free. He doesn't wear a mask. He's the only one who's free.
Yeah, I mean, definitely saw like shades of Austin books where like marriage is more of a, like, it's pragmatic, right?
It's a pragmatic transaction, you know. It's always been, I think, marriage is, even though we deny it and we say, oh, it's true love, but there's always, I'm a cynic when it comes to that. So it's
and you also compare it to, you know, like Sun Yat-sen, who notoriously had more than one wife. Sometimes, at the same time, right?
Yes, he had. I don't know how many wives he had, because there's the official ones and the non-official ones. And that, you know, to tell Leslie that he believes in equal rights, and then Leslie asks him, you know, but if you can have many wives, why can't I have many husbands? And he says, no, that's against the order of nature. So that's again, it shows the hypocrisy of humankind. It's basically hypocrisy. When we look at Somerset Maugham's works, we always think that, oh, he only wrote about murder and affairs and scandals. But actually, he was writing about hypocrisy, the hypocrisy of society in his stories. He was trying to show
And it makes sense, because he was, like, you know, he was gay and he had to fight against so much in society.
Yes, but he also, like many of us, he was also a hypocrite. It's hard to be pure and noble, because we're not perfect. So,
so Somerset is a real life person. How was it cultivating his personality in your book, and, you know, not making him stiff, I guess, making him like a real breathing person in your book?
Initially it was quite difficult, because I had the idea that I would write in his voice. I found I couldn't do it.
Oh, that's right. It was in third person for his chapters.
Yes. And Leslie's chapters are in the first person. So you get to hear Leslie's voice directly. With Somerset Maugham, I tried to do it in the first person. I couldn't do it. I'm not talented enough. So it felt false to me. So I decided to make his chapters in the third person. And I discovered it worked much better, because he's such a well-traveled person, so his point of view, and he's very sophisticated, he's seen the world, so to have this third person voice open up a wider vista for the reader, whereas with Leslie, she's very, her life is very narrow and confined, so her voice is just the first person, and it shows how constricted her viewpoints are. It worked as a very nice contrast between these two characters, subconsciously to show the reader as well the differences between these two characters, and also to help the reader differentiate the voices so that they don't get confused by the chapters.
And also he's the writer, he's writing down her story, so there's always going to be a degree of separation. So I think that really makes sense that you made it a third person voice for Somerset.
Well, your book is out now at booksellers everywhere. How has the reception been? How has your book tour been?
Very good. We've had very good reviews already. Since yesterday, the book was launched yesterday in Brooklyn at the Center for Fiction. And we've really had a lot of good reviews coming in. So I believe my publisher Bloomsbury told me that it's gone into the third printing already. So that's that's very gratifying. Yes.
Yeah. Congratulations.
Yes. Thank you.
I know you're in the middle of promoting this book, but do you have any other books in here right now, or are you just like focusing on this?
No, I'm focusing. I haven't been able to write anything for the last since August last year, because I was one of the judges for the International Booker Prize, which is for works translated from foreign languages into English. We from between September, August last year until May this year, we had to read 135 novels.
Oh, wow.
So it was basically a book a day. Wow. And then after my duties as a judge were finished, it was promoting this book in the UK, which came out in May, and now in the US. So I've been on the go for since last year. So,
yeah. It feels like we read a lot of books for this podcast, but a book a day seems like a lot of books. Yeah.
Well, thankfully, they were all quite... some of the novels were very European because they were 60 pages long, so very European. But some of the books were also very European because they were 900 pages long. So it's...
Oh, there's no middle lane. It's just 60 pages or 900 pages.
Yeah. So with no paragraph breaks. Some of them. Yeah. Just one chunk from page one to the last page. Just one paragraph.
Your favorite type of book, Rira.
Wow. I know, my favorite. I mean, it's also really nice to see more books being translated into English, yes, and also vice versa. Like we're getting more Asian American authors, for example, having their books translated into their native languages.
Yes,
so it's been quite interesting to see each other's reviews. You know, like what the motherland thinks of, what diaspora country thinks of.
But so much of it must be well translated, because you know that's so important. If you read a badly translated novel, then it's going to put you off reading that author again for a long time. So it can't be a rush job. It can't be a low budget job. It for translators and for publishers who are translating, I think they must focus on quality, not just of the original writing but also of the translation, because otherwise it does a disservice to everyone involved. I think it's very important for that.
Yes, and we will side eye all of the authors who italicize their native word, languages and their translated works. Yes,
yeah.
I think we've moved past that phase. In literature
Yes.
Now.
Yes, yeah. They just have to suck it up and just accept it. If you don't understand the word, go and Google it. That's all. Yeah.
Well, congratulations on the launch of your book. Congratulations on getting longlisted for the Booker Prize again. Thank you for coming on the show with us. And
thank you, Marvin and Rira. It was really fun chatting with the both of you. Thank you very much for having me on your show.
Well, it was lovely having you.
And that was Tan Thuong Eng, the author of The Gift of Rain, The Garden of Evening Mists, and most recently, The House of Doors, which is available now at booksellers everywhere, including the Books and Boba online bookstore. As always, if you purchase a book off our website at booksandboba.com, you support not only the Books and Boba podcast, but also your local bookstores. And if you'd like to support Books and Boba more directly, please consider joining our Patreon. Like we mentioned, you not only get access to our members-only Discord server where you can interact with us in real time, but also our monthly bonus episodes, which if you tune in this month, you'll learn all about my recent European honeymoon. I'm excited to share some stories from that trip with you all. Stay tuned for that. But before we go, Rira, can you remind us what our Books and Boba book club pick for October 2023 is?
Sure. We are reading Natural Beauty by Lingling Huang, and it is a novel that follows a young Chinese-American pianist who takes a job at a holistic wellness company, think Goop, where she learns the extent to which her new employers will go to make their privileged clients happy. So it is a creepy read. I heard that there are some trigger warnings about body horror, gore, and there's like a scene of sexual assault. So if any of those triggers you're sensitive to, just approach with caution. But I'm pretty excited to read this book. I have not picked it up yet. I have half of a month left, so I better get on it. But if you guys have any thoughts, please share on our Goodreads forums or on our Discord if you guys are a Patreon member. We'd love to hear what you guys thought and also to incorporate it into our conversation.
Yeah, I have not started this book as well because, as with a lot of horror things, I've been putting it off because I am a wimp. So
wasn't this a Patreon pick, by the way?
Yeah, this was suggested to
us by our patrons. Yeah, because you and I are very adverse to like horror, creepy, gore stuff, and this sounded not so bad, but we haven't like jumped in yet, so I don't know. But this is definitely a book that Marvin and I would, you know, kind of be adverse to picking at first. So we're really glad that we got suggestions from our Honey Boba members.
Yeah, so happy to be forced to read this book.
Yeah, thanks. Yes. Woo, spooky month.
Thanks so much. Yeah. But with that, that'll do it for this episode of Books and Boba. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you to Tan Thuan Eng for joining us. And we'll see you all next time.
Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to Books and Boba. This podcast was hosted by Marvin Yue and Rira Yu and edited and produced by Marvin Yue. Follow the book club on Twitter and Instagram by going to @booksandboba and engage with us on Goodreads on our Goodreads group. You can also check out past episodes of the podcast by going to booksandboba.com and by subscribing to us on your favorite podcast app. Don't forget, you can support Books and Boba and Asian American authors by purchasing books at our bookshop.org account. Check out the link in our show notes and also at booksandboba.com. Books and Boba is a proud member of the Potluck Podcast Collective, a collective of Asian American hosted podcasts featuring unique voices and stories from the Asian diaspora. Learn more about the collective and check out our fellow Potluck shows by visiting the website podcastpotluck.com. Thanks for listening.
I'm Charlene Kay. I'm a musician, songwriter, and guitarist. Growing up, I loved music. Whether it was pop, acoustic, emo, I ate it all up. But as a Chinese-American kid living in Scottsdale, Arizona, I also felt isolated, never really seeing artists who looked like me or shared my experiences. So after years of performing on stages all over the world, I wanted to create a space to highlight the amazing Asian musicians who I knew were out there, just not always getting played on the radio. That's why I started Golden Hour, a podcast where Asian singers, songwriters, instrumentalists, and music producers share their personal stories. And it's a space for you to discover your new favorite artist. Listen to Golden Hour with me, Charlene Kay, wherever you get your podcasts. Part of the Potluck Podcast Collective.